clerk will call the docket.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Court. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if it could please. My name is Jack Moss. I'm a lawyer in Louisa, appearing on behalf of Adam Toghill. The only issue on which this Court granted Mr. Toghill an appeal or a writ is whether the Court of Appeals correctly determined that Virginia's former sodomy statute, Virginia Code Section 18.2-361A, was constitutional as it was applied to him. If so, it would have been proper for him to be convicted of internet solicitation to commit sodomy. If not, he was improperly convicted. As this Court has said many years ago, the standard review when you're dealing with a constitutionality question is de novo. Now, not surprisingly, the Commonwealth in this case has thrown up several procedural bars that would keep this Court from addressing the issue on its merits. The first is Mr. Toghill's failure to have raised the constitutionality argument in the trial court. Now, accepting the Commonwealth's argument in this case would be the easy way for the Court to put off for another day this very difficult and important question, but the Court of Appeals did grant the writ under 5A18, so it could address the issue on its merits. The Court resolved against Mr. Toghill, and this Court granted the issue under Rule 525. Now, although the Commonwealth has said, well, proper respect for the trial court necessitated raising this issue with it, you know, honestly, we're past that. The question of respect for the trial court, I submit, is outweighed by the respect for the rule of law and for federalism, which in this case indicates that a manifest injustice has occurred because of the questionable constitutionality of former Section 18.2361A. I think the Court needs to address that question. The Commonwealth is simply wrong that arguing his assertion of unconstitutionality requires you also to conclude that the internet solicitation statute as well is facially unconstitutional. One does not necessarily follow the other. All the acceptance of Mr. Toghill's argument necessitates is a finding that a Virginian cannot be convicted of soliciting conduct under statute that, at a minimum, is unconstitutional as applied. Commonwealth's argument that even if there's merit to the ends of justice argument, that Toghill waived that by failing to present legal authority governing the exception is erroneous as well. This Court knows what the rules are for ends of justice, and this Court has decided it needs to address this. I understand that back in 2004 that the Court of Appeals and Askew declined to exercise or apply the ends of justice exception to a claim very similar to Mr. Toghill's. And Commonwealth argues that that should control this case as well. But the difference is that in Mr. Toghill's case, the Court of Appeals specifically accepted it and said, we need to deal with this. So I believe, does this Court. The Commonwealth's next attempt to block this Court's addressing the merits of Mr. Toghill's appeal is an argument about the application of stare decisis. And as this Court said just last year in Gibson versus Commonwealth, stare decisis is not an inexorable command. The Court said several years ago, our strong adherence to the doctrine of stare decisis does not compel us to perpetuate what we believe to be an incorrect application of the law. And finally, just 3 years ago in Home Paramount, this Court said the doctrine of stare decisis was never meant to prevent a careful evolution of the law. And that's what I think we need to be looking at today is how the law is evolving. With all respect to the Commonwealth, its argument about stare decisis, I think, leads to an absurd result. If any appellant who tries to overturn a precedent of this Court is precluded from asserting that the Court of Appeals erred by upholding its precedent, then cases that involve issues that only you can resolve would never be reached by you. Similarly, it would have been possible to argue the Court of Appeals, as the Commonwealth suggests, that McDonald had been wrongly decided and ought to be reconsidered. They couldn't reconsider it. You are the body that can do that. That's why we're here today. Now, a few moments ago, I quoted the court about its recognition of its duty to be involved in the careful evolution of the law. Quite honestly, the state of the law today is not even close to what it was in 2007 with regard to sexual contact among Virginians.
Counsel, before we go to the merits, on this procedural issue, the Court of Appeals opinion actually took the case based on the fact that it was a subject matter jurisdiction issue and it could be raised sua sponte at any time. The only issue that you addressed was a manifest injustice. I'm wondering, do you disagree with the subject matter jurisdiction position that the Court of Appeals took?
No, ma'am, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. So.
Counsel.
Yes, sir.
Before you get into the policy arguments, which is where I think you're heading at this point.
Yes, sir.
Frankly, I think the key issue is whether the statute is, whether the argument is unconstitutional as applied or facially unconstitutional. The Commonwealth's brief spends a great deal of time, a great deal of space, talking about the facial invalidity issue. And I'd like for you to address that either now or at some point before your time expires.
Okay. Well, certainly, Justice Mims, Virginia statute, of course, which was recently amended by the General Assembly, used to prohibit intimate contact, oral, and anal sex. And that, even though the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Lawrence really did not involve a similar statute, what Lawrence did, of course, was they overruled Bowers, which had a Georgia statute that was virtually identical to Virginia's. To the extent that the federal court has said you can't have an overly broad statute and leave it to the courts to interpret, to narrow that so that individuals may or may not know whether what they're doing violates the law, it invalidated the statute of Bowers on its face. Our argument in this Court of Appeals here was facial unconstitutionality, but when the Court of Appeals rendered its decision, it said it was unconstitutional as applied. I guess the concern that the Commonwealth has raised is, well, if the statute was unconstitutional, and as this Court said back in 1880 in Lee versus Harlow, that unconstitutional laws are void of initio, what does that do to all the people who are currently in prison serving sentences for it?
Counsel, let me see if I can focus it one more
okay.
time. I'm going to quote from page 17 of the Commonwealth's brief.
Okay.
A statute can be facially invalid only if there is no constitutional application. Do you assert that there is no constitutional application for this statute?
As it was written at the time?
Mm-hmm.
My argument would have to be there is no constitutional application short of the courts engaging in judicial activism to make it constitutional. Yes, sir.
Okay. You may go on.
Thank you.
Is it judicial activism when a court acts in a manner to preserve the constitutionality of a statute passed by the legislature? Or is that a proper deference to what the legislature does have the authority to do, and simply a reaction by a coordinate branch in deference to make sure that the will of the General Assembly, as far as it can go, is in fact enforced?
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, we articulate the deference to the General Assembly, and we presume that they know what they're doing, and sometimes, of course, we find out that they don't. That they've made mistakes. They end up having to go back and correct. What they've done in this particular case is, with the sodomy statute as it was at the time, they've gone back and they have changed it last year just to conform to what they believe is necessary to pass constitutional muster. It's
but a rule of construction of a statute when it gets into a court has existed for countless years, I mean over a century in the United States, that a court avoids a constitutional problem by interpreting a statute in a constitutional manner. I fail to understand how it could be categorized as judicial activism when what it probably is judicial restraint, not to declare the statute unconstitutional on its face.
I think the Fourth Circuit in McDonald versus Moose, when they talked about whether or not it was possible to construe Virginia's statute in such a way that it would be constitutional, came to the conclusion that for such a construction to be adopted would amount to basically a judicial activism that they
well,
did
I read
not
that.
Appropriate.
And, you know, fortunately, we're not bound by anything the Fourth Circuit says.
Oh, I agree.
And I happen to disagree with their observations and think that it's contrary to years and years of legal principles.
And
but that's another matter altogether.
And certainly the supplemental materials that the Solicitor General provided yesterday, that law review article from Richmond, would suggest that.
Right.
So. But, yeah, it was just...
Well, so while we're talking about McDonald, you're
yes,
familiar
sir.
With the case that it's really McDonald that brings us here even more so than Lawrence. You're familiar with the Fourth Circuit's opinion as well as Judge Diaz's dissent, I presume?
Generally, yes, sir, Justice Mims.
Okay. Judge Diaz makes the argument that the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, AEDPA, should have prevented the Fourth Circuit from reaching the constitutionality of Virginia's former statute. Your brief doesn't deal with that, but on oral argument, I wanted to give you the opportunity to explain why you would disagree with Judge Diaz's statement.
Yeah, I would have to look at her, at the dissent judge and Mr. Justice.
Okay, maybe you could do that then on your rebuttal time if you'd like.
I could. It looks like I have about 3 minutes left.
You have so. 3 minutes left.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Stuart Raphael for the Commonwealth of Virginia. Lawrence versus Texas held in 2003 that the Due Process Clause protects private sexual conduct between consenting adults, but the Court made it clear that it was not condoning sex acts with children or sex acts between adults in public. In 2007, this Court held in McDonald versus Commonwealth that Virginia's sodomy statute was constitutionally applied to a 47-year-old man who engaged in oral sex with two female children above the age of 15. Two of the three cases that you're hearing today involve sex acts with children. One involves a sex act in public. The assignments of error are all very similar and ask whether the court should overturn its decision in McDonald versus Commonwealth and agree with the Fourth Circuit's panel decision in 2013 in McDonald versus Moose. And for ease of reference, I'll refer to the Virginia 2007 case as McDonald and the Fourth Circuit 2013 case as Moose. We have to start, I think, with Lawrence in order to analyze, if you reach the merits, to analyze the facial invalidity question. If you search Lawrence for the terms facial or as applied, you won't find a discussion of that. But what you do find is a very clear statement at page 578 of the U.S. reports, where the court, in the opinion by Justice Kennedy, makes clear that the present case does not involve minors. It goes on to say it does not involve public conduct. The case does involve two adults and goes on to talk about how they were engaged in an intimate act in the privacy of their own home. This court cited that language in Martin versus Zaherl in limiting the fornication statute but not striking it down in its entirety, and you cited that disclaimer from Lawrence in your decision in McDonald versus Commonwealth in 2007 in upholding the Virginia statute as applied to the conduct in that case. Interestingly, the court in Lawrence remanded that case to the trial court. The trial court dismissed the sodomy charge, but the statute in Texas remains on the books, as it does in Georgia, as it does in North Carolina, And we cited the Georgia Supreme Court decision from 2013 in the Watson case. We submitted that to the court yesterday. We submit that this court correctly decided McDonald in 2007 for the reasons I've just mentioned. When you look at the Fourth Circuit's decision in Moose, the court errs in its understanding of the difference between a facial and an as-applied challenge. Justice Mims, I think you put your finger on the essence of the case. This court has adopted the distinction between facial and as-applied challenges that was set forth by the U.S. Supreme Court in Salerno and by the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington State Grange. In Montgomery County, Justice McClanahan, writing for the court, adopted the Washington State Grange definition of a facial challenge as being one under which no set of circumstances exists under which the statute would be valid, i.e., that the law is unconstitutional in all of its applications. That's very similar to the standard that the court set forth in Janes versus Commonwealth in 2008, where it cited the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Salerno. So the other relevant aspect of a facial analysis is that, except in First Amendment overbreadth cases, you do not reach the facial question if you can resolve the case based on the as-applied question. And that was the holding of this court in Volkswagen versus Smith in the opinion by Justice Koons. If the case is constitutionally applied to this defendant, you don't reach the facial question. And that is an aspect of judicial restraint. Mr. Chief Justice, you're exactly right about that. Now, even though this court didn't reach the facial question in McDonald, we would submit that you essentially decided it by holding that the statute was constitutionally applied to the conduct at issue in that case. Because given that it is constitutionally applied to a broad range of conduct that is not foreclosed by Lawrence, then you cannot meet the facial test of invalid in all circumstances. Now, the majority of the Fourth Circuit panel in Moose really relied on two arguments for coming up with a contrary conclusion. The first one was it reasoned that Lawrence overruled Bowers. Bowers had upheld the Georgia sodomy statute. Lawrence said, the majority in Moose said, Bowers was a facial challenge, and therefore by overruling Bowers, Lawrence must have intended to strike these statutes down facially. That was the first part of the analysis, and you'll find that at page 163 of the Fourth Circuit opinion. Here's the sentence. The Lawrence court thus recognized that the facial due process challenge in Bowers was wrongly decided. The big problem with that analysis is that Bowers was not a facial challenge. Take a look at footnote 2 of the Bowers decision. Justice White says in Bowers, the only claim properly before the court is Hardwick's challenge to the Georgia statute as applied to consensual homosexual sodomy. We express no opinion on the constitutionality of the Georgia statute as applied to other acts of sodomy. So the Fourth Circuit just got it flat wrong. Bowers was an as-applied challenge, not a facial challenge. The second ground for the panel's decision in Moose was reliance on this U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Ayotte versus Planned Parenthood in 2006, which was the case involving what the scope of remedy is once the court declared a portion of the a parental notification in an abortion case, declared that piece of it unconstitutional. But ironically, the Supreme Court adopted the right rule in Ayotte, which should apply here, and that's the court said at page 328, generally speaking, when confronting a constitutional flaw in a statute, we try to limit the solution to the problem. We prefer to enjoin only the unconstitutional applications of a statute while leaving all other applications in force. That's the rule that ought to apply here and that you all applied in the McDonald case in 2007. The court in Ayotte identified three considerations that a trial judge should apply in determining the scope of the remedy. All of those considerations argue in favor of upholding the Virginia statute. The first one was, the court said at page 329, we try not to nullify more of the legislature's work than is necessary. Well, that applies clearly here. The second consideration was the extent to which the court would have to engage in complex legislative drafting to save the statute. If it's really hard and complex, then that would argue in favor of broader invalidity. If it's an easy fix, that argues in favor of a narrow ruling. And, of course, that applies very well in this case since the court's already limited the Virginia statute. Lawrence did it in 2003, effectively, but this court clearly did it in 2007. So that consideration argues in favor of upholding the statute. And the final consideration was legislative intent. Would the legislature have preferred what is left of its statute to no statute at all? That consideration very strongly argues in favor of upholding Virginia statute because The General Assembly did not change the statute after 2003 when the Lawrence opinion came down. It didn't change it in 2005 when John Singson and McDonald came down in the Court of Appeals. And it didn't change it in 2007 when this court upheld the statute as applied. So clearly the legislature wants that statute to be used for cases that are not precluded by Lawrence. So all three of those considerations in IOT argued in favor of upholding the statute. The Fourth Circuit just got it plain wrong, and Judge Diaz was absolutely right in his dissent in that case. Now, I want to address a couple other considerations that the amici have raised. One of them is, aren't defendants going to be ping-ponging back between this court and the Fourth Circuit if you uphold the validity of the Virginia statute? Aren't they going to go across the street to the Fourth Circuit? Yes, there is a conflict. So some of these claims will be foreclosed by procedural default, but there will be some claims, no doubt, where you will have a conflict between this court and the Fourth Circuit. We submit that that is not a good reason for this court to adopt the wrong rule. You should do what you think is the correct ruling, and we submit that the answer on that one is pretty clear and obvious. Now, the Fourth Circuit can reconsider its decision on bank, and an opinion by this court would be a very good incentive for the Fourth Circuit to revisit their ruling in Moose on bank. The Supreme Court of the United States could grant certiorari in one of these cases to resolve what is going to be a clear split. But the Fourth Circuit is an island on this. The Fourth Circuit opinion is the only one that struck down the statute facially in this country. This court upheld the statute as applied in McDonald, and North Carolina and Georgia have upheld their statutes as well. So following a bad ruling in the Fourth Circuit is not a good idea. The other point I want to address on the merits is the federalism point that the Chief Justice raised earlier. The court in Moose purported to leave it to the Virginia General Assembly to rewrite the statute and said courts shouldn't be rewriting statutes. But that, of course, ignored that the statute was authoritatively construed by this court in 2007, and the General Assembly didn't see fit to change the law until 2013. In fact, all three of the convictions, the indictments that are at issue today, were brought after this court affirmed the validity of the statute as applied in 2007. So the panel decision in Moose really undermined federalism concerns and frankly disrespected the traditional approach of deferring to a state court in its interpretation of a constitutional provision. Let me address the procedural default issues. We argued all three of these cases had procedural default problems, and they are briefed. But the court, seeing that it's granted the assignments of error in all three, is maybe wondering which of these three cases is the best case on which to reach the merits if you want to reach the merits. I do need to say something about the theory of the procedural default, however. The theory of all three appellants here is that if a statute is unconstitutional, it's void, and therefore the objection can be raised at any time, including on appeal. That theory cannot be reconciled with the three most recent opinions by this court. McDonald, where you held that the facial challenge was waived in the trial court. Jones, in 2005, where you held that the First and Fifth Amendment challenges to the Arlington Ordinance were waived in the trial court under 5:25. And Bradshaw, in 2004, where you held that a facial challenge was also waived. So there is dicta in earlier cases that talks about a void statute, unconstitutional statute being void, and an issue could be raised on direct appeal, maybe even on collateral review. But the better rule is the more modern rule that you have applied. If you allow a criminal defendant or anyone else to raise arguments based on constitutionality for the first time in this court, you're going to be seeing a lot more as applied and facial challenges. The better way to do it is under the ends of justice exception under 5:25. So if there is a case where a person is convicted under a statute that's clearly unconstitutional and you think, conclude it is not a crime, then you can reach that under the ends of justice's exception. But the broad theory that the appellants here are advocating is too broad and is inconsistent with your most recent case law. Okay, so given that analytic framework, which of these three cases is the best one if you want to reach the merits? And we don't deny that there would be utility for this court to reassert that the statute at issue here is constitutional, both as applied to these gentlemen and facially. The best case, though, would probably be Talk Hill, this one, because this case is here on direct review. The issue was raised for the first time in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals reached the merits under the ends of justice exception. The other two cases, Saunders and McClary, that you're going to hear next, those cases involve serious procedural defaults where the issue was not raised at trial or on direct review. It was raised for the first time sometimes years later in a revocation proceeding. So of the three cases, the one that presents the least problem with the default is Toghill, this case. And it also presents very strong facts on which to support the application of the Crimes Against Nature statute, because this case involves a 37-year-old man who solicited sex from a 13-year-old girl. The Commonwealth, as I said, we don't deny the utility of addressing the merits here, notwithstanding the procedural defaults. We're not waiving the procedural defaults. But as we pointed out in our briefs, there are some 93 people on the Virginia Sex Offender Registry with convictions under this statute. There are about 40 inmates who are being held on convictions under this statute. The statute has been amended, and you're not going to see these issues going forward, but there are too many serious offenders who were properly convicted under this statute after this court upheld its validity, and for that reason, the court should affirm.
Thank you. Rebuttal? You have 3 minutes.
It would seem to me that if with the Court of Appeals having said we are finding this to be unconstitutional as applied, that certainly one way to address the concern of the Commonwealth to prevent opening the floodgates for people whose convictions are final is to say, all right, we've now decided this is unconstitutional as applied. This is a new rule of law which is only effective prospectively. I have to disagree with my colleague that this is not a case of a 37-year-old man having soliciting sex from a 13-year-old girl. This was a man who was chatting with a law enforcement officer who was posing as a child. Virginia certainly has an interest in protecting its children from predators. I dare say that same interest is not as strong when what you're dealing with is a law enforcement officer out there fishing.
Counsel, are you making the argument that if, in fact, he thought he was chatting with a 13-year-old girl, correct?
He thought. Yes, sir, he did.
So if, in fact, it was a 13-year-old girl, his communication and his intended actions would not have been any different. Is that correct?
As far as those actions went, Justice Mintz, remember, this is one chat that lasted approximately 80 or 90 minutes. And it ended without any kind of a meeting. It ended with no conduct. As a matter of fact, the law enforcement officer typed at the end, Are you still there? Because Mr. Toghill chose to break off that conversation. He was arrested several days later in Richmond once the officer figured out where the IP address was and where he lived. But there was nothing that indicated that he was doing anything other than talking to this person on the internet. And of course, that's one of the issues the Court of Appeals dealt with. This court did not grant a writ on, so I hadn't briefed that. And before I run totally out of time, you had asked a question about
Judge Diaz's dissent.
Yes, sir.
Do you choose to answer the AEDPA argument of Judge Diaz?
I was trying to listen to the Commonwealth at the time. I hadn't gotten down that argument, Justice Green. I'm sorry.
I'll tell you what. Let me quote Judge Diaz to you. While we review a district court's denial of habeas relief de novo, in adjudicating a federal petition for habeas relief from a state court conviction, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 limits the federal court's power to issue a writ to exceptional circumstances where the state court decision on the merits, quote, resulted in a decision that was contrary to or involved an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court of the United States. Again, quote, if this standard is difficult to meet, that is because it was meant to be. That's quoting from the Harrington case of the United States Supreme
Court. Yes, sir. I see a paragraph you're referring to.
Have at it if you'd like.
Would you restate the question?
Do you wish to respond to Judge Diaz's argument, which the Commonwealth asserts is persuasive?
It would be dangerous for me to do so without having thought about Justice Mintz.
Okay.
All right, your time has expired.
Thank you.
Call the next case.